From WBUR Boston, I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Jennifer Boatwright and Ron Henderson got pulled over for a minor driving infraction in Tenaha, Texas in 2007. An officer threatened them with jail time and losing their child to foster care if they didn't hand over money they had meant to spend on a used car. We have forfeiture laws in place to take away the money, cars, and houses of people who obtain them illegally. Think Bernie Madoff or a drug kingpin. But there was no evidence Boatwright and Henderson had done anything wrong. This hour on Point, the use and abuse of forfeiture laws. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation never ends. Have we struck the right balance between law enforcement and individual rights? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is Sarah Stillman, staff writer at The New Yorker magazine. Her compelling new article this week is called Taken. You can link to the article on our website, onpointradio.org. Sarah, thanks so much for being with me.
Thanks for having me, John.
Let me start, before I get into the details of the article, by asking you how this entire issue came to your attention.
Well, you know, I've been reporting on issues related to the drug war for a while, and the last piece I did was on the police use of young people as confidential informants in the war on drugs. And I encountered, in looking into a case in Detroit of a young woman who had been who had become a confidential informant after being found with a small amount of pot on her person, that in a related case, someone had had a large sum of cash seized from them without what seemed like my conventional notion of due process, you know, without any criminal charges ever being brought against them. So I said, that's interesting. How exactly did that happen? And as I started looking into it, I learned of this whole area of the law that I was completely unfamiliar with, known as civil asset forfeiture.
Well, how could that happen is the question that screams out from the article that you've gotten this week. Take us down to Tenaha and tell us what exactly that you found there.
Well, in the town of Tenaha, which is in Deep East Texas, there was a drug interdiction program that resulted in a large number of people, upwards of hundreds, maybe even up to 1,000 people, who were driving often from out of town down the highway and were pulled over often on what's called a pretextual traffic stop. You know, maybe they were driving too long in the left lane without passing, and they're pulled over. And
is that actually an infraction?
That's an infraction that the case you mentioned, Jennifer Boatwright and Ron Henderson, that's what they were pulled over for. And when the cops stopped them and asked them, you know, do you have any drugs in the car? Do you have any cash? It turned out that they did, in fact, have a large sum of cash, around $6,000, that they said they were taking to buy a used car from their father. Ron's father was in Linden, Texas, and so they were going there on an annual visit. They said to walk the wildflower trails. There's a big festival there, and ultimately, you know, after the officer alleged that he smelled marijuana, which he did not find in the car, but nonetheless, they were taken to the police station, and the district attorney arrived at the scene and essentially offered them a deal. She said, you know, on the one hand, you could face felony charges of, you know, child endangerment and money laundering, in which case they would go to jail that night and their children would be placed in foster care. Or alternately, they could sign this waiver that would essentially allow the town and the county to keep the cash, and they could go on their merry way just that same night.
And what did they choose?
And so they chose to sign the paperwork, which also sort of gave away their right to contest. And then they drove on down the road with their kids and went on. The next day, though, the next week, they did go to the FBI and said, you know, this just doesn't seem right to us. We didn't know that it was, you know, illegal to have cash.
How much cash did they have?
And they had $6,000.
Now, is there any reason either that the law enforcement officers uncovered or that you have encountered just by reporting this story to doubt the used car purpose for having the $6,000 in the car?
You know, I think the big issue here is that actually, you know, a part of due process and a part of the way our legal system is structured is that, you know, we have a system in place for kind of digging into these claims and sort of subjecting them to scrutiny and, you know, coming to conclusions. And, you know, that's, you know, normally what the legal process would look like is that if you believe that someone is sort of guilty of a crime, then you, you know, bring criminal charges against them and you prove a case and then the cash is taken. And I think, you know, it's an idea that most people are very comfortable with and, in fact, support the idea that, you know, in cases of what's known as criminal forfeiture, if someone's convicted of a crime, they should not be allowed to have the proceeds of that crime, whether it's, you know, $6,000 or whether it's a nice mansion in Malibu or whether it's, you know, Bernie Madoff's millions and millions. And so the question here was really, you know, was partly, you know, because hundreds of people had were similarly pulled over and later a class action lawsuit was brought on behalf of many of those people who, you know, did not have evidence of contraband in many of the cases in the car. You know, one of the issues at stake is, you know, if there was something criminal happening, then let's prove it. And I'll just make one other important point, I think, which is that in many cases, they did actually find, you know, large sums of drugs in the car or sometimes, you know, such large sums of cash that it was quite likely associated with criminality. And in those cases, too, people were actually allowed to sign a waiver and essentially no charges were ever brought against them. People who were found with large sums of cocaine were essentially said, you know, let us keep the money here and we'll let you drive on down the road.
I want to go to that point again, but just to return to what I was asking about a moment ago, the impression that one draws from the article is that the Jennifer and Ron were entirely blameless in every way. And what I'm wondering is are you thinking that the nature of this case was one where there wasn't adequate proof or probable cause, or that actually this entire veneer of suspicion was made up out of whole cloth?
Well, you know, I think one thing that's quite telling is that the district attorney, when the couple did push back and say, you know, we actually do wish to contest and, you know, go ahead and bring criminal charges against us if you think you can prove them, at that point, the district attorney did, you know, write a letter and say, you know, we don't believe that we have the evidence necessary to bring a case and we're going to drop this. And so, you know, that I think in and of itself speaks volumes. But, you know, I think, as I mentioned, there are cases, you know, in this case or in others where I mentioned, you know, a marijuana pipe was found in the car or there was a scent that was suspicious or, you know, there were things that fit the criteria for, you know, profiling of drug couriers. For instance, you know, people driving rental cars, people going from this destination to that destination known to be a popular spot for narcotics. I think the real issue is, you know, again, you know, those are charges that need to be proven through due process.
Well, and that begs the question that I had after reading your article, which is, you know, you described this program as a drug interdiction program. You could also read your article and say it wasn't a drug interdiction program at all. It was a criminal enterprise on the part of law enforcement to finance their budget, to pay bonuses to officers. Do you think it was more the former than the latter?
Well, it was very surprising when I saw the records of what exactly they were using these funds that they had seized on. And, you know, I list in the story a number of those uses. They include everything from, you know, poultry festival supplies to personal bonuses that went directly to some of the law enforcement officers involved, around $40,000 worth. So it was actually a sizable amount of the salaries of the people who were enforcing these laws, which, you know, I think introduces a very troubling question about, you know, profit incentives and profit motives in policing.
Well, you conclude the article with there's an allusion to piracy. Do you think that Tenaha was running a piracy operation?
Well, that's certainly what you know, there was this legal case brought, a class action suit on behalf of many of the people who had been subject to this. And, you know, the court seemed to support many of those claims. And just last week, they actually reached a settlement.
What was the experience like for you as a reporter being in Tenaha? Were you fearful that you were going to be accosted in the same way?
Well, at one point, it's such a small place that instantaneously I was sort of noticed and was followed by a police car. But
New Yorker writer kind of place.
I was very intrigued to find that so many people, sort of internal to the town leadership and the county leadership were actually really willing to talk about what they saw as very problematic, including actually a woman who Stephanie Stevens, who actually was the district attorney of Nacogdoches just nearby Tenaha, and actually became ultimately one of the people bringing the case against the county involved in this operation. So I think that alone was telling, that someone like her would have been willing to get on board with this, and that so many people in the town who originally had actually been quite supportive of the operation ultimately came to recognize it as, you know, highly problematic.
Well, so is the conclusion that you drew was that this was a program that started for one purpose, that for whatever reason, whether it was the motivation of the individuals or how it played out in practice, turned into something else?
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's hard to trace some of the evolution, because another big problem with many of these cases is that there's very, very little transparency. But in this case, due to the lawsuit, a huge amount did come to light, and it certainly reflected the fact that huge amounts were being seized, often from people who were not found with any evidence of contraband, and that the money was used for troubling sort of purposes.
Including directly into the pockets of some of the officers, right? Through bonus payments?
Correct, exactly.
And it sounded as if you had a city council member who had concluded that this had gotten out of control.
Exactly. And she and many other people in the town spoke up as well, a local judge and a lot of the people who were very afraid to speak out, who had been pulled over as well. So you had people on all sides of it. And many officers actually came forward to
right.
me, officers in local towns and officers who are still active, who said, you know, I have questions about this policy,
Sarah,
which is
Stillman.
Happening across Texas.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how states and local governments use forfeiture laws and what happened in Tenaha, Texas. We're talking with Sarah Stillman, author of Taken, in the current issue of New Yorker. You should know we put out calls to three of the plaintiffs in the Tenaha case, as well as to the town's current mayor and police chief. Did not hear back from any of them. Sarah, talk to me a little bit. I mentioned that we tried to get the police chief, about the police officer in this case, who he is, and how he looked for people that he would pull over as part of this program.
Well, Barry Washington was a very well-respected officer in Texas for more than 20 years with the Department of Public Safety. And after that long career, he wound up coming to this very small town, Tenaha, and it appears proposing essentially to start doing drug interdiction on their highways. He had been known to have, you know, pioneered many of the tactics that are so popular in sort of the war on drugs. And those include, you know, what we talked about earlier, the notion of, you know, pretextual traffic stops, this notion of really establishing a list of sort of subjective criteria of how you identify people who may in fact be sort of drug couriers or drug traffickers.
Is Barry Washington white or black?
And he's a black officer. And so this was a complicated and nuanced case because, you know, when they analyzed the statistics of what happened in terms of the people who were being pulled over after this program began, what they noticed was that what the lawyers who were bringing this class action case, which involved racial profiling charges, noticed is that, you know, disproportionately, in a very marked sense, many, many of the people who were being pulled over were people who were least likely to be able to fight back. Many of them were people of color. Many of them fit these things that we mentioned earlier, like driving a rental car, coming from a place like New York or Florida. In some cases, you know, in one case I recall, a young man, when they opened his luggage in the car, they said, oh, well, you know, these clothes look too baggy for you. And some people were told, you know, you seem too nervous when you're pulled over. And other people were told, well, you don't quite seem nervous enough. And so,
Sarah,
I think,
did it complicate the case for the plaintiffs that the officer who was implementing a program that had disproportionate effect on African-Americans and Hispanics was himself African-American?
I don't believe so. I mean, I think that where we're at in our kind of understanding of racial politics these days is that, you know, I don't think things are ever so so clear cut. And I think it's part of what makes this case really interesting to look at is it's also worth emphasizing, you know, in Tenaha, police were certainly, it appears, you know, really stretching the bounds of the law. And in many cases, it was sort of successfully argued violating the Constitution. But it's also true that, you know, across Texas and across the country, police are simply enforcing the laws that are on the books and that really fundamentally this is often a policy issue that looks very different state to state. But, you know, these are things that are actually in many places, you know, perfectly legal to do. The idea that you can take someone's cash or someone's home based on things that could not necessarily be proven as criminal charges in a courtroom. And I think that's perhaps one of the most important issues at stake here.
Well, you mentioned different states. In fact, you've got an example in your New Yorker article from Philadelphia where an elderly couple faced the loss of their home because of infractions involving their grandson, drug infractions. Talk about that case.
Their son, right. That actually was one of the most sort of startling to me, which it involved this elderly couple in West Philadelphia, the Adams, and they essentially, they'd been living in this home for literally almost half a century and had been, you know, hardworking people who had been law-abiding. In fact, the woman, Mary Adams, had actually been the block captain in the sort of Philadelphia More Beautiful campaign. And it turns out that her son, who was living in the home at the time, was found to have sold $20 worth of pot on the porch three times to a confidential informant. And about a month later, on the third sale, a raid happened at the home and the son was taken away to jail. And criminal charges have not yet been proven against him. But nonetheless, a month after the raid, the family opened the door and found that a group of police arrived and said, you know, essentially the Commonwealth is endeavoring to take the home, and they learned that they would have to fight for the home that they've been living in for half a century based on these $20 pot deals and other sort of allegations that were brought but still remain unproven against the son.
So it was the son, not the grandson. That was my mistake. But they have been spared the threat of losing their home. Is that right?
Well, they believe the case is actually still open, and often these cases take many, many months or even years to resolve. So this has been hanging over their head for quite some time. But they were very lucky because in civil forfeiture cases, it's important to emphasize that people are not actually entitled to a lawyer. So that's another big difference between criminal forfeiture and civil forfeiture, is that a lot of the conventional entitlements people have, the protections that people have, don't exist. So in this case, the family, which they did not have money to hire a lawyer, they were very lucky to find a law clinic at the University of Philadelphia, University of Pennsylvania, run by Lou Rooley, who actually took up the case, and he had law students working on their behalf. And so it appears that they may be able to successfully come to a settlement in that case.
I want to go to one listener, Sarah, before we let you go. We've got James on the line from Nashville, Tennessee. James, go ahead. You're on with Sarah Stillman.
Hello. Wow. There are several fundamentals of Western civilization which are being run roughshod over. Innocent until proven guilty, equal protection under the law. None of the government's business what they're doing with the money until a crime has been proven, okay? I myself use more and more cash because of the propensity of hackers to try and get into my bank account and empty it out. It's happened more than once, okay?
James, thanks so much for your call. I'm going to ask Sarah about that issue. Sarah, that was one of the things that I reflected on in reading your article was, if you assume that many of the people who were stopped and had money confiscated in Tenaha were innocent of serious crime, there were a lot of people who had a lot of cash in their cars.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, there are two answers to that. You know, one is the one I brought up earlier, which is that, you know, even in cases where that cash was sort of there for nefarious purposes, it makes sense to investigate that and to, you know, perhaps bring criminal charges instead of letting people go down the road in order for the police to be able to take and use that money.
Of course, yes.
But secondarily, I think one thing that was sort of surprising to me is encountering, you know, the number of people I interviewed, people all around the country who, you know, live in a much more sort of cash-oriented economy than I do. I'm used to, you know, always putting my money in the bank. And these are people—
I think a lot of our listeners are in that situation. They simply don't carry large amounts of cash.
Yeah, and in some cases, you know, for instance, I noticed that's often the case with some people who are undocumented immigrants who are actually not allowed, I believe, to open a bank account in Texas, and some people who simply were elderly and felt like they were more comfortable operating in a sort of a cash economy. Other people, I mean, there's so many reasons that people may feel more comfortable dealing with cash. And the real issue is that it's not illegal to have cash.
Right. Sarah, let me ask you one thing before we let you go. We saw during the 1990s a move to reform laws at the federal level after members of Congress concluded that these laws were being abused. Are we seeing any corresponding effort at the state and local level because of publicity like you've provided and others have? I realize your article just came out. But are we seeing much of an effort to tighten up these laws so that people don't have their rights abused?
Absolutely. I mean, I think there's been sort of wide debate about these issues. And, you know, it varies so tremendously from state to state. And some states have really built in protections to kind of to sort of mitigate the profit incentives. And in some states, funds that are acquired through forfeiture go into a general pot or maybe go to education funds or go to drug rehabilitation as opposed to
officer bonuses.
Exactly. So that makes sense, you know, as one rudimentary protection. But there are other places, like in North Carolina, where they've actually been proactive about saying, no, you're going to have to prove criminal charges against someone in order to take their property or their cash or their home.
But I could also imagine that given the budget squeeze that we've seen on so many state and local governments, that there will be people who, at the local level, who are reluctant to give up this very promising source of revenue.
Exactly. And I think that's an important thing to have a conversation about is that we are, you know, police are facing a lot of strains. And as I documented cases in Detroit and also in Texas, where some counties, you know, around 40% even of their budgets may be comprised of, you know, forfeiture funds. So it's clear that, you know, we've created a system in some places where, you know, there's a real dependency there that in a time of budget strains is, you know, necessary to take a look at.
Sarah, it's a terrific article. A lot of people are going to find it stunning to see what's happening out there under these laws. I want to thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Now, joining us now from Durham, North Carolina, is Vinita Gupta, Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which has represented many plaintiffs in asset forfeiture cases, including in Tennessee. And with me from Phoenix, Arizona, is Cameron Holmes, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Arizona and Director of the Southwest Border Anti-Money Laundering Alliance, which was set up in 2010 to reduce money laundering in the Southwest border area. He began working in law enforcement in 1970, was the primary drafter of Arizona's forfeiture and money laundering statutes. He's the chair of the Arizona Forfeiture Association, an association of border state attorney generals and law enforcement agencies. Vinita and Cameron, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Hi, John.
Cameron, let me start with you, since we've just heard from Sarah about problems with these laws, and get you to make the affirmative case for why it's a good thing that we have them, and to get your assessment of the degree to which state and local governments are going over the line.
Well, of course, the primary purpose of forfeiture is to take the profits out of crime and to reduce the ability of ongoing crime to continue, similar to the theory used in Operation Desert Storm to reduce the materiel. We didn't go after personnel. We went after bridges and airfields and power plants in order to incapacitate the enemy. That's what forfeiture does by taking property used in crime from the criminal activity. The forfeiture of proceeds, of course, is even more obvious. If you run the risk of losing the money you obtain from crime, your incentive to do the crime is much reduced. And that's what the forfeiture proceeds does.
And how commonly do you believe that officials go over the line and misuse the laws to the detriment of the rights and privileges that that citizens ought to have?
Well, in my experience in Arizona, we haven't had any complaints similar to what we just heard from Texas. I don't think that that is a common circumstance at all. In fact, if it were accepted factually what the article says about providing direct incentives, bonuses to officers, that would be a direct violation of the Department of Justice and National District Attorneys Association guidance on avoiding appearances of impropriety in the financial dealings relating to the income from forfeiture.
Well, Vanita, let me bring you in. Cameron says not common at all, and that the practices in Tenaha were outliers that that violate industry standards. Do you think he's right?
Well, the ACLU has actually represented a number of people around the country, including in Arizona, actually, in factual circumstances that are similar, not exactly the same as in Tenaha. I think that Tenaha represents a very particular set of facts that really highlight the egregiousness of the practice. But I think what we have to understand here is that the way that civil asset forfeiture laws are set up around the country, there really is a systemic incentive that makes it too easy for abuse. Does that mean that every time that assets are seized through civil asset forfeiture that abuses are occurring? Of course not. But the reality is that these laws are so incredibly permissive. In Arizona's law, just by example, the standard to seize assets is very low. It's by a preponderance of the evidence. And money is permitted under the Arizona statute to go straight back into law enforcement coffers. Now, there are several states that have tried to curb abuses because of scandals like Tenaha or less, you know, of different variations of Tenaha, saying that we need to take out the profit incentive for law enforcement to engage in any abusive practices, that while we have absolutely a legitimate interest in preventing criminals from profiting from crime, North Carolina took the step to say that we need to have only, it needs to be done pursuant to a criminal conviction. Other states have done
Vanita, let me just stop to clarify one thing. You said that Cameron said we haven't had complaints like they had in Texas, in Arizona. You're saying that you have had those complaints.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, in Sarah's article in The New Yorker, she actually talks about an Arizona case, and the ACLU has litigated these cases in Arizona.
Cameron?
Yes.
What is your Vanita just said? In fact, there have been complaints in Arizona, and she cited a case that that Sarah wrote about in The New Yorker. What do you say to that?
Well, I am reluctant to get into individual cases, but I did supervise the Shamoon case, which she mentions, and I'll say in brief that her factual rendition of that case is horrendous. And the number one fact that she leaves out in order to make the impression that this was all about casual shoplifting is that these addicts that they were sending out onto the street to do their custom shoplifting, to stock their shelves at the liquor store, totaled between half and three-quarters of $1 million to stock the liquor store. And her acceptance of Shamoon's story that he didn't know that they had inadvertently obtained $750,000 at 90% discount from a string of addicts out the front door is the kind of thing that only the ACLU could possibly accept as fact.
This is On Point. I'm John Harwood in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about forfeiture laws and their use. We're talking with Vinita Gupta, Deputy Legal Director of the American Civil Liberties Union, which has represented many plaintiffs in asset forfeiture cases, including in Tenaha, Texas, and with Cameron Holmes, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Arizona and Director of the Southwest Border Anti-Money Laundering Alliance, which was set up in 2010 to reduce money laundering in the border area. Cameron, I just want to reset for this segment by going back to the article in The New Yorker, which we talked to Sarah Stillman about for the first half of the show. Is it your belief that at a fundamental level that article paints a false picture of the extent of abuse of this law, of these kinds of laws?
Yes, absolutely.
And explain.
What she's doing is accepting as a given fact assertions made by plaintiffs and plaintiffs' lawyers. She seems to be blind to the idea that while accusing the police of a financial motive, that her sources are all either plaintiffs or plaintiffs' lawyers, and they all personally benefit from their lawsuits.
Vinita,
she
what
doesn't delve into the implications of these sort of casual reform ideas, such as requiring a criminal conviction before a forfeiture can be obtained. And let me do that for you because it's important to see where that leads. If that were the law, a drug dealer or a major fraud figure could simply gift his proceeds to a third person who isn't involved in the crime or happens to be in another country. That person can't be convicted. And therefore, the entire forfeiture is defeated. Also, fraud cases in particular are done on a person-by-person basis, victim-by-victim. So let's say there's 1,000 victims at $100,000 each, $100 million in losses. The state, by great luck and hard work, finds $50 million of that. They can't put 1,000 victims on the stand in the trial. They pick 10 of their best victims. Only those 10 victims actually have a conviction to support the forfeiture of the money that is available. So that's 10 times $100,000, $1 million out of the 50 goes back to victims.
Vinita, let me ask Vinita to come in. Does the belief in the widespread abuse of these laws depend on credulousness to the point of blindness about what the plaintiffs in these kinds of lawsuits have actually been doing?
No, and I think that Mr. Holmes almost undermines his own credibility when saying that this is, you know, when kind of framing it that way. I mean, first of all, I just want to get back to a point that Mr. Holmes was making, that it's only kind of the ACLU and plaintiffs who have profit motive, which is ironic, to benefit from telling this kind of version of the narrative. You know, the ACLU has actually been working for civil asset forfeiture reform with a lot of libertarian and even conservative groups that approach it from a property rights concern and a real concern about the un-American nature of being able to obtain people's property without sufficient due process. Now, there are a lot of other remedies short of abolishing civil asset forfeiture, which, you know, again, only North Carolina has done so far and has even had an equitable sharing program with the federal government, frankly, has done an end run around their own state protections. There are other things that actually can be done which don't remove the ability of law enforcement to stem criminals or people accused of crimes and convicted of crimes from benefiting or profiting from criminal activity. There are states that have actually ended the direct profit incentive under their civil asset forfeiture laws by directing all seized assets into a general state fund. That immediately removes the direct incentive from agencies that are actually conducting the seizures from personally benefiting, using that monies for salaries and other things that are very particular to that law enforcement agency. So there are a number of states that have done that. There are other states that have actually imposed a higher standard of proof on in civil asset forfeiture proceedings, requiring, for example, by clear and convincing evidence, a link between the money or the asset and criminal activity.
Vanita, what about the point that Cameron raised about the Arizona case, and that what had been portrayed as casual shoplifting was actually a systematic effort to use drug addicts to come up with $500,000 or $750,000 worth of merchandise?
You know, it's that was not an ACLU case. That was a case by a private attorney in Arizona. So I can't get into the specifics of those facts. I can, you know, we could go on and on about the specific facts of cases where we have represented individuals who've had assets seized in far smaller amounts. Where, you know, and the interesting thing is what keeps repeatedly happening in the cases where that people actually contact the ACLU and seek legal representation because they had their assets wrongfully seized, is that in the vast majority of these cases, as soon as we kind of send a letter initiating or indicating that this person is now counseled and we are seeking various pieces of evidence, a videotape of the stop or whatever else, the money is inevitably returned to our clients. And so we have a lot of, you know, we could get into a lot of details about various cases that actually show that there is too much room for abuse. And so what I guess I don't get is the resistance to saying, well, you know, law enforcement may need this tool, but there are ways to really prevent the kinds of systemic incentives for abuse that would still allow law enforcement to continue to use a practice, but would really remove the incentives for abuse. And that's
a good government issue. Let's bring our listeners into the conversation. We have Kwaku on the line from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Kwaku, welcome to the show. Go ahead.
Thank you so very much, and I'm happy to give some insight. I am currently reading Michelle Alexander's excellent book, The New Jim Crow, and I was happy to see Michelle Alexander when she came to New Orleans. And as you know, she came and she spoke on the deep level of racism and white supremacy in terms of who stopped. When I had an old car, the police stopped me because they said I had an old car. Well, now that I have a new car, the police stopped me because I'm a new car. And I'm so suspected by law enforcement that I've simply gotten used to it. I make no sudden moves. I lower my voice. I turn down the music. So I want to bring into this equation who is targeted by these asset forfeitures, and it's particularly African Americans. And we are, meaning myself, be so outraged at this. And I want to say in conclusion, I didn't realize the depth and the magnitude of the harassment of African Americans, in particular Latinos, until I read Michelle Alexander's excellent book.
Kwaku,
the law enforcement officer is saying is pure bunk. We are stopped because we are black, and you're subject to a lot of harassment on these stops.
Kwaku, thanks so much for your call. Cameron, in Arizona, who is most affected by these laws, and what safeguards do you have in place to prevent the problems associated with racial profiling?
The vast majority of forfeiture dollars in Arizona are forfeited from fraudsters for the benefit of victims. The idea that the police are making money on these little tiny stops is just, number one, a misunderstanding of police budgeting, and number two, is fundamentally incorrect. Let me elaborate. No matter what the public or even many police officers believe, the police budget is what the police overseer, whether it's the city or the county or the state, want it to be. If they want it to be high, it's high. If they want it to be low, it's low. If there is forfeiture money that comes into that equation, it's just like grant money coming into the equation.
What about the racial aspect?
Wait a minute. What happens is other money is taken out of the budget and given to other parts of the city, county, or state in order to even out the total expenditure by that department. So there's no real benefit to the police. All they get out of it is a little bit of flexibility in the immediate expenditure. But even that is closely monitored by their accounting departments. If they wanted to buy, for example, a big expensive item, that would have to go to the city council. That would have to go to the mayor. That would have to go to overseers.
Cameron, can you address the race issue?
I'm sorry, I haven't read that book, and I'm not going to comment on it.
All right, let's go to another caller. Andrew is on the line from Fort Benning, Georgia. Andrew, welcome to On Point. Go right ahead.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I thought your guest from Arizona had a very good point on why being able to seize assets is important. But my question is, why would it be reasonable to be able to initially seize these assets for law enforcement purposes if they didn't get, you know, laundered elsewhere or anything like that, and hold them until there is a conviction and, you know, the due process goes, as opposed to immediately being able to disperse these to whatever agency that state or county puts these monies into?
Vanita, let me go to you on that. Is that a reasonable outcome of or a way to reform these laws?
I mean, that is one step or one reform that could happen, and that looks a little bit more like criminal forfeiture than where you are. The state basically is only entitled to use the seized assets where a criminal conviction is obtained. What we need to understand is that the vast, vast majority of states have much lighter protections on the ability to use assets that are seized even without arrest ever being conducted. And so, you know, I started to list out a couple of potential reforms that could take place that would not abolish civil asset forfeiture entirely, would still allow law enforcement to use it as a crime-fighting tool, but would really take away the incentives for abuse and the kinds of things that make it far too easy for the kinds of cases that we get involved with to actually happen.
Cameron, what effect would it have, in your view, on law enforcement if the caller's point were implemented, that stuff could be seized but not used or spent by the departments until convictions had been obtained?
You would still have the problems of the mismatch between the idea of conviction and the idea of responsibility. There's nothing un-American about losing money as a result of responsibility in a civil case. If I go to the doctor and he amputates the wrong leg, he doesn't have to be convicted for me to get compensation. If Exxon Valdez runs aground, there's no conviction, but there's billions of dollars in cleanup. British Petroleum in the Gulf of Mexico, there was no conviction. HSBC Bank paid $1.2 billion in forfeitures. There was no conviction.
Vanita?
I think what is missing here is that in those instances, there was due process. And I think due process really prohibits in this country statutory schemes or laws that create actual bias, the potential for bias, or even the appearance of bias in the administration of justice. And where you have direct financial incentives, those really raise the specter of improper bias. In this country, once assets are seized, the onus of establishing that those assets were wrongfully seized is not on law enforcement. The onus is not on law enforcement to prove that they were lawfully seized. It is actually on the owner to prove that those were unlawfully seized. And there's a burden. That burden shifting is critically important. The procedures by which to establish that something was taken from you you unlawfully are incredibly arcane. It is often extremely expensive to hire a lawyer, and when amounts are being seized in much smaller, and are in many of our cases, we've had clients who've had amounts of $1,000, $2,000, $3,500 seized. It costs around $5,000 to retain an attorney. And so here we're talking about a fundamental lack of due process in the way that the seizures are happening.
Vanita, I want to get to one other listener before we get out of this segment. We've got Michelle on the line from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma. Michelle, go ahead.
Hi, John. I enjoyed the show today. It really changed my opinion on a lot of things. I personally find forfeiture repugnant since it cuts off the rights of innocent people without adequate safeguards. But I got to say, I really think Cameron got the best of the argument today, especially when he pointed out that the ACLU has a tendency to paint the facts a little funny, and almost they lose credibility with me when I even hear that they're involved with something. So I think I'm going to reconsider my position on it.
Michelle, thanks for your call. Vanita, painting the facts a little funny?
You know, it's we should talk a lot more about why it is that institutes like the Goldwater Institute in Arizona, libertarian, sometimes conservative think tank, has written a huge report about the problem of civil asset forfeiture in Arizona. We are partnering. This is not a political issue. We've got this is a bipartisan issue about a fundamental concern around un-American practices that really get to the problem of incentives in the administration of justice.
Cameron, and, quick last. Last word.
We keep going back to incentives, and there's absolutely nothing in the forfeiture statutes that creates an incentive for law enforcement officers to do forfeitures as opposed to doing something else. I give you Arizona, in which the vast majority of the dollars forfeited are for victims. If law enforcement really wanted to make money, they would never do a victim case, because in victim cases, every dime goes back to the victims.
Cameron Holmes, we're out of time. Thanks so much for joining us from the state of Arizona. Vanita Gupta from Durham, North Carolina. You can continue, and the ACLU, you can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Coming up tomorrow, our weekly news roundtable. I'm John Harwood, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.